You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Señor Reyes. ¿Cómo estamos,
Welcome
tío?
Welcome to my territory. Welcome to my domain. I've been drunk there.
I know. Listen, let me let you in. How could a podcast between us not start Romeo and Juliet style? Very romantic, isn't it? Me calling down from the balcony. I'll come and let you in. Come in. Got a confession. Two or three nights ago, when I was walking, I was on talking romance, on a very romantic walk with my fiance through the streets of Granada. We were passing a bookshop. El Asterisco, I think it's called.
Yes.
And I happened to look inside and I saw a handsome young Spanish gentleman holding forth in front of what looked like a book club.
Yes. Yes, it was. Yes, indeed. We were discussing Joan Didion. Joan Didion. American author. Her first book.
Oh, wow.
We read it this month. But this is a fine Airbnb apartment you got here.
It is. Well, Fran, at this point, the listeners are probably wondering what's going on. Fran, you featured so much on the podcast during the Vuelta a España that I felt I needed to do some intelligence on you. I needed to. This is what we always do. We always go and visit the hometown of our contributors, unbeknownst to them, and spy on them for a couple of weeks. Hence why I was eavesdropping on your book club activities the other day. But, Fran, we're going to do the podcast today in Granada. We're going to link up with our guest in just a minute, but good to be here.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it feels like as if we were doing a live show, wouldn't it? I mean, we can go in your balcony and that way we would even have spectators.
Fran, just describe the day. We've already established that we're in Granada. We're in my little apartment that I've got for a couple of weeks. Describe the day, first of all, because this is not typical Granaino weather, is it?
Actually, I was thinking of it while I was pedaling to the city center. This is actually good weather, because if we were in autumn, in October, and it was sunny on blue skies, that would be a bad weather for the season. This is season-like weather. We still have 25 degrees, more or less, because we can be on a t-shirt. But the sky is cloudy. It feels kind of uneasy. You can even tell in the mood of the people that they feel a bit more stressed than they would usually do. And it's just that we are getting settled into autumn.
What about you? You feeling stressed?
I'm feeling very stressed. I have a lot of things in my plate this week, and particularly today. But on the other hand, I feel lucky and fortunate to be working on everything I'm working on.
Let's escape into the world of professional cycling, shall we, Fran? Let's take a break. Let's pause. You've got to finish your coffee there. What's the brew this morning?
I don't know. It's just usual café latte, café con leche. I didn't order a cappuccino because it was noon already. But
Nitro brew. I've seen that. You know, there are quite a lot of hipster coffee joints in Granada. I've seen the nitro brew on offer.
Yeah, they are trending. They are trending, and that's good because it offers you a vast range of choice. On the other hand, you have to be a real aficionado to actually care about the different brews and the different seeds and the different origins. In my case, I am not. So whatever is fine.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Indeed. If you're looking to hire somebody for your company, maybe the best way to find the right candidate isn't to search at all, but to match using Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed, because it's your matching and hiring platform with more than 350 million global monthly visitors and matching technology that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch all of the legwork and use Indeed for scheduling, screening and messaging so you can connect with candidates more quickly. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 75% of employers claim that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other online job sites. More than 3.5 million businesses worldwide are using Indeed to hire great talent quickly. And Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Listeners to the Cycling Podcast will get a £100 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at indeed.com/cycle. Just go to indeed.com/cycle right now and support the Cycling Podcast by saying that you heard about Indeed right here on the podcast. That's indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Now, in the minute or so that I've been talking to you, around 30 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed's data. So go to indeed.com/cycle. Now, before I hand back to Daniel, I'd like to say on behalf of everybody at the Cycling Podcast, a massive congratulations to Rose Manley, host of the Cycling Podcast Feminine, of course, and her husband, Phil Sheehan, on the recent arrival of the newest member of their family. A baby boy who, at the time of recording, is still awaiting a name. My suggestion that they should go for Taddei in this year of all years has, I didn't get a response, actually. I'm sure Rose and Phil are working on a name for their new arrival as we speak. But mother and baby are both doing well, and a huge congratulations from everybody here at the Cycling Podcast. And I'm sure you listeners will join me in wishing them all the best. Now back to Daniel and co for the rest of the episode.
Welcome back. I've just established in the last 3 or 4 minutes that Fran's in very melancholic mood, reflective mood. I fear the worst slightly for this episode. He's always in, wistful mood. So if he's feeling especially that way inclined, then I am quite concerned about today's episode. But it is time to step into the, I don't know whether it's a Ryanair flight or spaceship or transponder or something that takes us back to the United Kingdom. And our second guest or third co-host for today's episode is young Richard Abraham, who's not in Granada. He is in where, Richard?
Oxford. Is Granada a university city?
Yes.
I feel like it should be.
Yes, it is.
But I don't... Your mention of Ryanair flights, Daniel, has me worried. I don't want to be
involved. We were just discussing actually how it's, anyway, it's not an easy place to get to necessarily with big... there is an airport, Granada Airport, but it's not a big one, so one generally has to fly to Malaga.
Yeah, it's more like a plane station from the point of view that it has the same feeling as a bus station, the Granada Airport. But that is cute, you know. I mean, the lines are very short. You get to know everyone in the building once you travel 3 or 4 times. Yeah, you make acquaintances.
That's good. Richard, we've just been talking about Fran's book club as well. I sort of spotted Fran just through it was sort of late at night in Granada. I was sort of traipsing through the streets of Granada and I happened to, I saw a book club taking place, a book club meeting, and Fran was there sort of in very demonstrative fashion holding forth.
And he didn't came in to say hello, Richard. Can you believe that?
No, I didn't want to interrupt the great man. He was in full flow. Talking about being in full flow, it's about time, I suppose, this far into the episode, we start talking about cycling with our usual news roundup. We'll start with a completely random point on the cycling space-time continuum while going back roughly a week. We recorded last week's episode in a live link-up to Larry Warbass's bedroom in Varese. The next day, he was supposed to be riding the Trevalli Varesine along with Tadej Pogacar, among others. In the morning, the women's race did go ahead and was won by Cédrine Kerbaol of
Ceratizit.
I'm always unsure whether to pronounce that in a Spanish fashion, Fran, but it's a Spanish company, isn't it? They make tools.
They make tools. They're actually German. I mean,
the team is German.
It belongs to the German group WNT. And I don't know exactly whether Ceratizit is a Spanish company or it just has very big, large headquarters in the north of Spain.
Yeah, I've only ever seen it in Spain. That's why I was inclined to pronounce it in a Spanish way. The men's race started but did not finish due to divine interference. And that was how I was going to describe Enric Mas attacking. But no, I mean the bad weather. Enric Mas was some distance ahead of the peloton, was he not, when they called that off?
With four minutes gap on the peloton. Can you believe that? I mean, I think we have never seen him on that situation on a race, not even in his junior years.
Very, very sad as well for the race organisers, the Trevalli Varesine. We talk a lot on the podcast about the crisis of Italian cycling. It's one of the smaller organisers, and well, they were denied the spectacle of Tadej Pogacar in particular riding that afternoon. That was very unfortunate. Next up for the men was Gran Piemonte, a race which changed its identity as often as most pro cyclists change their bar tape. Lots of course changes over the year, date changes. When I see it on the calendar, I don't know exactly what I'm going to get. It's kind of settled into a bit of a classics, typical kind of classics configuration. A bit of climbing, Fran, riders like Mohoric, who were very prominent the other day, and victory for Nielsen Paulus of Education. Easy Boast, Corbin Strong second there, and Alex Aramburu third. It was a cracking race, was it not?
Yeah, it was beautiful, especially with this fight between Paulus and the guys chasing him. I think it was a very interesting one, and I completely share what you said. You know, it's like a very mixed race also, because their successive changes, I think that they have disoriented even the peloton on itself.
The problem that RCS have, or the problem they've created for themselves, is they've tried to ring fence the word Giro. They don't want to use the word Giro for any other race except the Giro d'Italia. That is why they now refer to the Giro di Lombardia, Tour of Lombardy, which we'll talk about in a minute, as just Il Lombardia. Of course, there used to be a Giro del Piemonte with a long and distinguished history, but they've created Gran Piemonte, and as I say, no one really knows exactly what it is. I'll go next to a stage race, the CIMAC Ladies Tour in the Netherlands. Stages there won by Zoe Backsted, Lorena Wiebes again, Barbara Guariski, and Lotte Kopecky. Kopecky catching Escapi Silke Smulders of Liv Alula-Jaco, I believe 17 metres from the line on that last stage in Arnhem, and also winning the GC by a mere 2 seconds over Franziska Koch of DSM Firmenich Post NL. We'll get to Lombardy a bit later. Skip ahead to Sunday, when Olympic and World TT champion Grace Brown completed her glorious farewell tour by winning the Chrono des Nations, her final race as a pro in the men's race. Stefan Kung pipped Jay Vine by 2 seconds. Chaps, I also wanted to mention the European Gravel Championships that took place yesterday in Asiago in the Veneto region of Italy. Very beautiful course, some gorgeous gravel roads, trails up there on the plateau, the Altopiano di Asiago. The men's race was won by Martin Stoschek of the Czech Republic. The women's race by Sina Frey of Switzerland. Both races were overshadowed by the sudden death of Silvano Giannis, who suffered a heart attack and collapsed 3 kilometres into the amateur race. I wanted to mention this because, I tweeted about this yesterday. Silvano Giannis was a bit of a cult figure up there in the Trentino region of Italy. And he came to sort of wider attention because Gilberto Simoni, who won the Giro d'Italia, of course, a couple of times, he was once asked in an interview. This was the time when Lance Armstrong, the controversial Lance Armstrong, was dominating world cycling. And he was asked whether Armstrong was the strongest rider in the world. And Simoni replied, no, it's Silvano Giannis. And of course, no one knew who this fella was, this sort of weekend warrior. And it turned out that Simoni used to train with him. And he was this sort of, as I say, he became a bit of a mythical figure. He'd never really turned professional. He had competed. And he was significantly older than Simoni, about 15 or 20 years older than Simoni. And he won a litany of World Masters Championships on the road, Gran Fondo, mountain bike as well. And I remember interviewing him on the back of this quote from Simoni, getting hold of his number. I think I looked it up in the Italian yellow page, Pagine Bianche, and this is kind of internet 1.0. It's kind of a shame that this sort of thing
not a shame for privacy.
It's not a shame, but you know, this kind of shows how some of the mystique has gone from professional cycling as well, because, you know, this name came out of nowhere in this interview by Gilberto Simoni, and yeah, you could just about find out who it was, just about look him up. And the tragedy that occurred yesterday has of course been followed by a lot of tributes in the Italian press and Italian online media, but over the last 10 or 15 years, of course, there's been a lot of, well, it's been very easy. If one wanted to find out information about this gentleman, it would have been very easy, because all of his results are online and, you know, you can look up photos and so on and so forth. But he really became a sort of cult figure, a cult hero in a particular region of Italy. And he was 69 years old, and that made it a very sad event yesterday. What should have been a joyous event, because as I said, it was a gorgeous course, everything that sort of gravel racing should be, or people want gravel racing to be, and it was very much overshadowed. One other thing I was going to mention, chaps, was that it was the African Championships, Continental Championships at the weekend. Henok Mulubran of Astana won the men's race. Ashley Moorman won the women's. This came in a week when we got the alarming news that the Q36.5 Continental team will close at the end of the year. On the excellent global cycling Substack, Dan Challis published an open letter from that Q36.5 Continental team's manager, Kevin Campbell. And in that, Campbell talked about the sort of negative trend in representation for African riders at the top level. He said, we pointed out, there were 23 African riders in World Tour or Pro Conti teams in 2014, and it looks as though there'll be fewer than 10 next year. Now, this is not necessarily something that people have talked about a lot, partly because, of course, we had this great eureka moment this year of Biniam Gamay winning the green jersey and three stages of the Tour de France. That was greeted as a huge breakthrough for African cycling. But if you scratch the surface, mm-hmm. 1 year away from this huge, another, what's been hailed as another breakthrough, it should be, for African cycling, the World Championships in Rwanda, and things don't look quite so rosy, do they?
I mean, African cycling faces, like any other non-European racing scene, huge challenges from the point of view that the events that are held there, they are not the perceived to be the global cycling scene. They are not a big pot, and that means that sometimes it is challenging to first set up and really establish an event in the long term. And from the point of view of the development of a team or of a rider, this creates a lot of uncertainty. And we wanted to see cycling thrive in Africa in the same way that it has done in Asia, where there is a proper racing scene, and you can set up a continental team like there are several in Malaysia or the Philippines that actually race around the continent and can have a return of investment of their own without necessarily traveling to Europe, which is the hotbed and where the biggest races are held. Yet we have failed to see this in Africa because the events remain very low key and the teams prove to be unsustainable. A couple of years ago, we had a talent management agency setting up a cycling team and disbanding it after some of the talents actually fled the team and fled the cycling scene just to become refugees in the United States. And many of those attempts we have seen fail. I really hope that the World Championships in Rwanda do create some kind of legacy that helps the African cycling scene establish itself, you know, and also North Africa and Morocco, Algeria, there are cycling races, there are projects, but these are projects that are looking more towards Europe, towards jumping the Mediterranean Sea and joining Europe, than to creating a proper African cycling scene, which I believe is the real stepping stone.
I mean, numbers don't always tell the whole story, do they? because I remember I saw this story and I was a little bit taken aback by it, because like you, Daniel, I remember at the tour that breakthrough moment, and I think you and I remember bumping into you when we were both interviewing Skabu Gyomai, who had a group of young African riders, didn't he, with him. That was the World Cycling Center, wasn't it? I think he's involved with.
Yeah.
And so that this was off the back of Biniam Gamai's first stage win in the tour, and that sense of optimism about the future of cycling as a sport and the pathway for young African riders had sort of been paved by what Gyomai had done. And so this seems in contrast, but I think when you read stories like this and people involved in that grassroots pathway start to say these sorts of things, this is more telling than the numbers are. And I guess as well, like, let's take the British scene. There have never been more British riders at World Tour level. However, the British scene itself, I think, undeniably in one of the worst situations it's been in for a long time. So I wonder whether it's sort of a slightly bigger issue than just what's going on in Africa. That's not to say that there are not issues that are unique to that continent or the countries within it. But it was a sort of slightly jarring to read that and see that news this week.
I think there's a real fickleness in the cycling transfer market as well. And over the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen, and we keep talking about this cult of youth, and it really affects, you know, last week we had Larry on, who at the time of recording hadn't signed a deal for next year. And Larry's 34, and a lot of the older riders in the peloton, and riders who, I suppose, as we talked about with Larry, I think last year, you know, they're not, if you look at their pro cycling stats page or their first cycling stats page, you know, they're not necessarily the most attention grabbing in terms of results. They've really suffered from this cult of youth, but there are other sort of subsets, like possibly African riders who 10 years ago certain teams were willing to sort of just gamble on, and it can, I suppose, from their point of view, for team managers' point of view, it can feel like, you know, putting a dime into a slot machine every now and again and just taking a gamble. But now suddenly, over the last 3 or 4 years, the heads have sort of been turned by, and you know, rightly so, because it's been proven that 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds can be competitive. But their head has also been turned by the likes of Pogacar and other very precocious riders. And it feels to me that on average, in every team, 2-3 spots are being taken up by that kind of gamble rather than another type of gamble. Go back 8 years, for example, and these were South Americans because that was fashionable for a time, and I think there's been a squeeze on that sort of African rider as well, as well as, you know, these pipelines like, unfortunately, the Q36.5 continental team being shut off.
And without this becoming the European employment law podcast for a week, it is still tricky to legally employ riders from Africa, isn't it? I remember this was reported about Gyomai during the tour, because Arkea, or whatever Arkea was known as a few years back, had shown a lot of interest. They were the first team that showed interest in Gyomai when he was riding for the World Cycling Center, I believe. And in the end, the French employment legislation or tax legislation, whatever it was, meant that they were like, well, it's not worth it. That's too much work for us to try and make this happen. So in the end, it was Intermarché, wasn't it, that he first signed for? I think that kind of were willing to put that investment in. It's not always as straightforward as, can we gamble a place on the roster for this individual? So it does require quite a bit of work and red tape to make this happen.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Well, chaps, almost 20 minutes into the podcast, probably actually more than 20 minutes, and we've barely mentioned Tadej Pogacar. I did flirt with the idea of restricting us to sort of 10 minutes of Pogacar chat today, because these podcasts in which we sort of gaze at our navels and discuss what we all feel about his dominance, and maybe they are becoming a little bit repetitive as his victories. However, we are going to indulge in more Pog chat in due course, because at the weekend we did have the final monument of the year, Il Lombardia Tour of Lombardy, the race of the falling leaves, the race of the falling dreams, shattered dreams more like. It's becoming four consecutive victories for Pogacar, of course. But before we talk about what happened, chaps, the race was foregrounded, the backdrop to the race was an interesting story which broke two nights before Il Lombardia, and it broke courtesy of, thanks to, a social media post from Tom Pidcock of Ineos Grenadiers, who said he had been deselected from the Ineos Grenadiers team for Il Lombardia. Of course, he was in good form, and he said this in the same Instagram post. He said he was in excellent form, as evidenced, as exemplified by his second place in the Giro dell'Emilia last week. Now, the backdrop to the backdrop, of course, we discussed in last week's podcast that Pidcock, we knew, and Richard called it speculation, I knew that it was excellent reporting by me and others. No, it was reporting. I didn't know that.
I think I speculated that it could be speculation.
Yeah. I had established, Richard, I had it on extremely good authority, that Q36.5 were very interested in Pidcock, and in some way, shape or form, negotiating, discussing possible transfer. We're correct to talk about transfers, because Tom Pidcock is not at the end of his contract. But they were one of several teams interested, and it was very much a developing situation. And one of the permutations still on the table at that point was that Pidcock might even, well, this is what we were being told, he could even possibly stay at Ineos Grenadiers. However, deselected from Lombardy, replaced by Ethan Hayter, who is leaving the team at the end of the year. Significant, I would suggest. This wasn't just a case of them denying a rider who was in the departures lounge a chance to ride for the team for the last time. So replaced by Hayter, and obviously pretty miffed. Now, latest about this situation, this morning, breaking news, stop press. Well, not much to report, really, chaps. There's a bit of an impenetrable fog of silence, a wall of silence around Pidcock, Ineos, everything that's going on. However, I was told this morning that what was previously considered to be a matter of weeks has been accelerated. We should have some kind of resolution. And by resolution, I think we would all agree, we probably think that now means Pidcock leaving Ineos Grenadiers. We should have a resolution within, I would suggest, days. As soon as possible, I was told.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense, because it is today that the first deadline for the registration of UCI teams applies. So the audit, well, the first stage of the audit begins tomorrow, and it's by today that they have to send it, all the contracts and the bank guarantee, and for the calculation of the bank guarantee, there is the salaries are the rider salaries are the biggest chunk of it. But I guess that they already had Tom Pidcock into account in their Ineos bank guarantee. I wonder if the new team did have him, because that is a huge contract to take in and to fit in.
But there are no real consequences for not having What are the consequences, Fran? Do you know, for not having a fully sort of up-to-date, polished list?
So the thing is, when you draw your bank guarantee, that has to be drawn before the start of October this year, you need to calculate how big your salary mass is going to be. And this, I see Richard's face, and I wonder.
We're drifting in. I could see this coming. It was becoming the European Employment Law podcast for this week, and I can see us drifting down this rabbit hole of legalese and employment rules.
No, it's okay. I'm going to cut it very short. If a team that didn't take into account Tom Pidcock's big time contract for the first bank guarantee, they need to draw up and either they need to amend the bank guarantee or to produce a second bank guarantee that covers that contract.
So it's all very mundane, administrative sort of box ticking. But Richard, What does it all mean? I mean, we don't want to speculate too much. We never like to speculate too much. However, I suppose the one thing we can be pretty confident of, and I've already said this, is that any uncertainty about whether Pidcock would stay or go has been removed.
Yeah, it does look like this is the final bridge burned somewhat, doesn't it? It's difficult to see a way back for Pidcock and that team. That's not to say it's impossible, but I think the optics, I hate using that term, sorry. but how this appears from the outside isn't good for either Pidcock or for Ineos, is it? The last minute, because I don't even know from the results actually where the first Ineos rider was, in fact.
15, Timon Arensman.
Timon Arensman, that's right. I mean, who's to say whether Pidcock would have done better than that or not, but certainly on paper seemed like their best chance given his performance the week before. So it didn't look a particularly good decision to... And the way that it was announced with Pidcock sort of mentioning it first on Instagram and clearly, you know, there was some... disappointment, let's put it lightly, sort of veiled behind, or veiled not very strongly behind his language on Instagram. It doesn't look good for either party. So and I wonder what if Pidcock does leave Ineos Grenadiers, he's by all accounts does account for a large quantity proportion of their budget. Are Ineos going to sort of try and replace him?
Well, they might
find another.
They might try. However, I think we sort of touched last week on what options there might be, obvious options available. There aren't many, and it would probably involve breaking some contracts. But as we increasingly see, that can be done in the right circumstances. I don't see anything out there that's going to immediately alter the sort of the destiny of this team over the next year or two, or the way people feel about this team. Before we started recording today, and at the risk of this really turning into the European law or employment law podcast, I did sort of hint to you guys that as a cycling fan, observer, journalist, it might be worth keeping your eye over the next few weeks and months on what is happening in football with a gentleman, a former player called Lassana Diarra, a French player, who, he is currently going through the courts, and he and his legal team, because way back in 2014, he wanted to leave Lokomotiv Moscow. There was a dispute over wage payment and so on and so forth. And as you'll be able to gather, this was 2014. It's taken an awfully long time to play out. But we have a situation now whereby if he and his legal team win the case they have brought in the Belgian courts, and this is to do with the freedom of movement, kind of restraint of trade as well, I suppose, you may have a situation in football whereby if a player, for example, is offered a bigger salary than the one they are currently earning at another team, there is nothing to stop them without any kind of transfer fee, without the prospective employer paying any kind of penalty clause, just jumping ship effectively, because keeping them under the contract they've signed, it would be seen as kind of restraint of freedom of movement. That is the sort of extreme outcome of this case. However, there could be implications for cycling as well. Interesting when, as I said last week, and as we've discussed with these longer contracts in cycling, these situations are going to come up more and more frequently, that riders are going to want to move before the end of their deals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even the UCI has created some new regulations in order to actually have a proper transfer system, you know, and a proper transfer scene in cycling. So this would disrupt the whole thing.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by MAP.
Chaps, should we leave it there in anticipation of further developments in the coming days and hours? And let's talk, in fact, about what happened in the race itself, Tour of Lombardy in Lombardia. Good weather in Bergamo for the start of the fifth monument of the year, 255-kilometre route. We talked about it last week. There was a slight change to the route. The Passo di Ganda was replaced by the Selvino climb. That wasn't going to change things too much. That was very early in the race. However, a strong group of 13 riders did form just before the Selvino, I think. That featured, and this was interesting, featured some, I suppose, outsiders for victory: Matej Mohoric, Antonio Tiberi, both of Bahrain victorious, so two Bahrain victorious riders, and they weren't the only major team represented in numbers early in the race. On the descent of the Selvino, a few other significant riders went away. Timon Arensman, we just mentioned him. A third important Bahrain victorious rider, Damiano Caruso, Mari van Sevenen, Tesh Benoit. Eddie Dunbar had also been in one of those moves. Danny Martinez has some pretty big hitters. And I think that said a lot about how everyone was feeling about Tadej Pogacar and this race. 23 riders eventually then came together at the front, and UAE didn't give them much of a leash. They kept them on a tight leash. I think their maximum lead was around about 2.5 minutes. And inevitably, therefore, UAE did burn a fair few matches, keeping that under control. Then the race came to the Colmar di Sormano climb, just over 50 kilometers to go. This was where we thought, and the sort of eagle-eyed observers had noticed, that Tadej Pogacar had done some kind of effort on the Colmar di Sormano climb in his recon a couple of days before. They thought that might be a bit of a dress rehearsal. And sure enough, 48 kilometers to go, off he trotted. Pogacar just, I suppose, significantly, a mere, 100 meters after the bridge. So they were going up the Colmar di Sormano the opposite way to the 2020, wasn't it, Tour of Lombardy, when, of course, Remco Evenepoel coming down the Colmar di Sormano, he went off the road just before a stone bridge, and there was a lot of panic alarm about what he might have done to himself. He did suffer bad injuries, but we feared even worse than that at the time. And it was just after that bridge, going the other way, that Tadej Pogacar launched a move that no one really tried to counter, probably having learned their lessons from early in the year. Remco Evenepoel and Enric Mas were sort of the best of the rest as he took off. But, that was pretty much the end of the story, wasn't it? As far as in Lombardia was concerned, Pogacar quickly got a gap of a few seconds, which then stretched to well over a minute, and then 2 minutes, and then he would finally win the race by 3 minutes and 16 seconds over Remco Evenepoel, who finished alone. Blissful solitude, not so blissful, having taken a beating from Pog again. Remco Evenepoel, pseudo quick step, 3 minutes, 16 seconds. Then in third was Giulio Ciccone of Little Trek. Then we had, Fran, a couple of your compatriots, John Izaguirre and Enric Mas. An excellent Pavel Sivakov, sixth. Leonard van Etveldt, seventh. Paulus, eighth. Gaudu, ninth. And Sandro Moirisa of Alpes in De Koenig, rounding out the top 10. I'm also going to mention Lucky Larry, the Motown maestro of Decathlon Âgé d'Oser La Mondiale, who finished 34th. Of course, as I said earlier, still no news on where Larry's going to be riding next year. We very much hope. We would implore team managers to make sure that isn't Larry's last one-day race in the World Tour, last monument. But very credible showing for Larry. Give him a contract, for God's sake.
You don't have to buy him out of anything.
No, exactly.
It's really amenable. Yeah.
Well, and he's had a very good season, Larry. Again, someone whose performances are not necessarily always reflected in results, but he's been fit throughout the year and always positioning his leaders where they need to be before key climbs.
Yeah.
So an absolute travesty that Larry still, well, as far as we know.
Would you sign him for the podcast? I mean, if he doesn't get a contract with a World Tour team, will he get a contract with the cycling podcast?
We'll put him on a 20-year contract, Fran, with no break clauses.
Okay.
Ineos can come at us with whatever they want, with all the petro dollars they want. He will not be leaving the cycling podcast. He doesn't know this, of course, yet. Anyway, chaps. Yes, so... The task now falls to us to come up with something new to say about Tadej Pogacar. I mean, first, I would say that from a purely statistical point of view, Pogacar emulated Fausto Coppi by winning his fourth Il Lombardia in a row. Alfredo Binda has also won four Il Lombardias, but they were not consecutive. And, well, there were some of the sort of legacy media, for example, L'Equipe and also La Gazzetta dello Sport, although albeit in much more understated fashion, they noted this with their front pages on Sunday. L'Equipe front page, Tadej Pogacar, Fausto Coppi, side by side. It was pretty much the whole of the front page in L'Equipe's case. And, well, those sort of superlatives, those comparisons don't necessarily seem out of place now, do they? Chaps, I'm going to gather my thoughts for a second and leave it to you to tell me. Well, Fran, you went on last week. This whole period, which has really, it's taken cycling, it's taken Pogacar, it's taken us in the way we react to this. It's taken this to a new dimension, I suppose. We've gone to a different level in terms of what Pogacar currently is representing in professional cycling. Your feelings, your thoughts.
Well, my thought has been for a while now that he's not racing against anyone, against any current rival. He's racing against history. You know, he's on his prime. He has probably a couple more of seasons of prime period in front of him, and he has set many records this year. He will continue to set records for a couple more years, and then afterwards somebody will come to dethrone him. Name it, be it Albert Philipsen, be it Paul Sexas, or be it Remco Evenepoel gaining traction, whatever, someone will dethrone him. But for a year or maybe two, we have to get used to this narrative on which he's nearly unbeatable.
You make it sound, and we'll get onto this in a minute, you make it sound as though it's a terrible burden. This is something we're not going to enjoy.
There is going to be less competition for the win. I mean, yesterday you said before that Lombardia was the race of the shattered dreams, and I guess the dreams were shattered beforehand. I mean, even before when you heard Remco Evenepoel talking on the eve of Tre Valle Varesine, saying that the season was feeling very long for him. When you heard Matteo Jorgensen saying that there was no way that they could beat Tadej Pogacar. And the other day, I mean, in Lombardy, at least, we saw the teams throwing everything they had at him. Because they put this big breakaway, they forced UAE to do a very long chase with elements that were, so to say, subpar compared to their best domestics. Because, of course, Fabio Christian does not have the same does not have the same engine, the same endurance as other UAE domestics has. And they failed to even make them hesitate. So, I mean, then this is going to be a trend, I believe.
I'm going to use up some of my Pogacar discussion quota here with something from L'Équipe that caught my eye. I guess it was in the same issue as the, like, behind the copy cover, but it was Alex Roos, who we've mentioned before. I think we've got a Kilometre Zero with Alex Roos, don't we? Sort of chief cycling correspondent for L'Équipe. And he wrote, "It takes courage, unless it's not just madness, to line up on a Saturday morning at the start in Bergamo, at the foot of the old town, huddled behind its Venetian walls." This is a very long sentence of Alex's, by the way, so bear with me. "For a final torture session, nearly 260 kilometres of suffocation, hands clenched on the bars, watching for traps, pitfalls, those golden dead leaves that promise so much sliding, those cracks dug by hard winters. All this while waiting only to know when Tadej Pogacar will decide to skin you alive." And I thought that kind of just sums it up. Sense of... hopelessness a little bit surrounding the rhetoric of Pogacar.
Yeah.
And I think we were discussing a little bit off mic about how the what more can we say, but it does feel like, to my mind, the World Championships and the last week, there has been a further cementing of Pogacar's sort of invincibility, I think, that wasn't there at the start of the year. It wasn't really there even, I think, after the Giro. I think there was still a lot of wondering what Pogacar we would see later on in the year at the Tour and then afterwards. But really, the way that he was able to sew up the Tour and then come back again and sew up almost everything that he wanted later on in the season. It's just in this last fortnight, I think, that he's attained that position of sort of... the Merckx comparisons become even stronger, don't they? But rider that
I was quite
alone.
I was quite saddened by the general reaction, and one should never make the mistake of thinking that social media represents what everyone feels. And I would contrast what we saw on social media with what we saw on the roadside in Lombardy. And I've already mentioned it once in the podcast this week, that we talk a lot about the crisis of Italian cycling and diminishing interest in Italy. However, you see at the roadside a lot of people who are very enthused. This was a good point, I think, made on the Lanterne Rouge podcast this week as well. They said that, you know, if you go to the race, what you want to see is the world champion going past first. You know, that is probably what is going to stir the most excitement. It sort of comes down to what we watch sport for. Certainly suspense is one of the things we watch sport for. However, you can find suspense anywhere. If you go down to your local park, you can find a football match that is close and which will give you suspense. What we definitely watch professional sport for is excellence. And sort of that suspense and certainty, it made me think of other editions of the Tour of Lombardy. Oliver Zaug winning in 2010. Are we going to get wistful and romanticized about the time when Oliver Zaug... I mean, one thing that he has got over Tadej Pogacar is that Oliver Zaug was a former chimney sweep, and I don't think Tadej Pogacar has ever swept any chimneys. However... I kind of feel that I must stress this, it's not our job to be fans. We have to separate ourselves from fans. But if I do for a second put myself in the shoes, in the skin of a fan, I think there's something kind of more affirming about the experience of watching someone at the top of their game, at the summit of their art. And, these are the eras that we tend to, later on, 10 or 15 years later, that we talk about and cherish more than those eras that can feel a little bit shapeless, when there is suspense, uncertainty in abundance. Richard, you talked about Merckx there. I think... I often, and I've said this many times on the podcast, since Pogacar has been winning at this rate, almost on a weekly basis, I've gone back to sort of look back at what I wrote in my biography of Eddie Merckx and sort of compare the different phases. And there are sort of distinctive phases in the Merckx dynasty. And there's a phase of resignation, and that applies to the people who were watching, the journalists, and also the riders his competitors. And I think that's where we are. And unfortunately, it is the mother of invention. Because, Fran, you've already mentioned, we talked about the caliber of riders that were going in the break at the weekend. And there is the chance that out of this period of, you know, people might say completely monotonous Pogacar domination comes a completely new paradigm of how to race. Mm-hmm. And we might see that next year, you know, Bahrain putting their three sort of biggest hitters, I suppose, in breaks early on. Mm-hmm. And I think the other place where it's the mother of invention is for us, as who are charged with talking about the sport and chronicling the sport. And, you know, great example of this, our friend Leonardo Piccione. I mean, you've already mentioned Alex Roos. Leonardo Piccione, Italian writer who's featured on our Giro podcast. He coined something at the weekend, which I suppose you would translate as Pog o'clock, Pogacar o'clock. He listed the times of Pogacar's winning attacks in major races in 2024. He says Strade Bianche 34 minutes past three, Liège-Bastogne-Liège 43 minutes past three, the World Championships 56 minutes past two, Giro dell'Emilia 36 minutes past three, Giro di Lombardia 42 minutes past three. So we've now, if nothing else, at the end of this season, we've got something which we can refer to as sort of Pog o'clock, and that is the time at which you can either, depending on your sort of proclivity, how you feel about Pogacar, you can either stop watching or, you know, to tune in just before sort of 3:30 Central European time, because you're probably going to see it.
This is what I love about cycling, is that you can, some of the few sports you can really do that sort of thing with. Mm. Maybe you just have to choose a race that finishes before 3:45 in the afternoon, because Pogacar will attack after it's already finished, so you've got a chance. Just thinking what you said there, Daniel, still Pogacar doesn't start every World Tour race. He doesn't start the vast majority of professional cycling races. It's not like a sport that's quite a closed shop. I think immediately a Formula One, but there must be others where that dominance is sort of so total. Like, it's the hegemony, isn't it? But if we are looking for entertainment within bike races, we'll watch the Vuelta. Like, if you don't like watching Pogacar in a Grand Tour, there is... I'd say probably however long the Pogacar dynasty lasts, he's not going to be racing three in a year, is he? So there's always going to be one Grand Tour. There'll be classics. There'll be all sorts of races. Thanks to cycling's steadfast refusal to modernize or sort of slimline itself and make itself into a more commercially interesting proposition. So,
I suppose the one caveat to what I've just said about, you know, sort of suggesting, and I said last week I wouldn't do this, suggesting that people should enjoy it more. But the one caveat to that is there is this more or less explicit, more explicitly sort of admitted, spoken idea that it is fundamentally suspicious in professional cycling that someone dominates to this degree. And some of the kind of turning up of the nose at the weekend and some of the sort of disgruntled reaction I saw online, it seemed to me more to do with people fundamentally disagreeing with the idea that anyone can dominate this much, rather than about Pogacar himself. It was just that, you know, particularly with what cycling has experienced, any time that anyone dominates to this extent, it is always necessarily going to be not only suspicious, but symptomatic of something untoward and unfair, illegal happening.
Mm-hmm. You were saying earlier that Tadej Pogacar may be creating around him a new paradigm when it comes to racing and strategy and such. And in my opinion, Visma and UAE do have created a new paradigm, you know, based on new nutrition strategies, based on new performance strategies, new training strategies, and also on getting a bigger talent pool than any other teams, you know. So they have created this new paradigm, and there will probably come someone afterwards with a new one to the front them. It's just a matter of time. As for narratives in the season, right, this year and the year before, we had a perfect narrative standpoint on which we had this big six, mm. on which there was the fading one in Primoz Roglic, mm. the growing one in Remco Evenepoel, those two top two guys in Tadej Pogacar and Jonas Vingegaard that could go head to head, and we had a certain uncertainty on whether on how it would turn out, pan out, and then those two odd powerhouses in Mathieu van der Poel and Wout van Aert that could turn any race upside down based on raw power alone. Now, Roglic is going to come out of equation because of his age, and there will be new guys added to narrative, and these new guys will bring the excitement. And I believe that for the best of the sport and for this excitement to be consistent, it would be great if one or two of these new stars that would make the big six become the big seven or the big four or whatever come from some cycling hotbed like Italy, France, Spain. That would be great for the narrative, because as of now, it's great to have talents from countries that are sort of alien to the traditional cycling hotbed, but having someone from these nations also spurs the audience and makes those events more sustainable, the events held in these hotbeds.
I was looking for an opportunity to shoehorn this story in because I had it written down, and I thought you'd mention it in the news roundup, Daniel. Did you see the Winkelkurse in Belgium last Tuesday? Well, the headline which caught my eye was Tim de Klerk takes on a horse. I'd never come across it before, but apparently this is an annual event in a little Belgian town where over a 400-meter race, a cyclist races a horse and trap up the high street. And, well, Tim de Klerk won. I mean, he took on the horse and he won. But
where are we going with
this? Where are we going with this? We're skirting the oncoming rapids of European employment law, and we're diverting round to San Remo and Roubaix. Now, my point is, like, I've found that quite sort of diverting as a story, because it's like, oh, I wonder what happens if, you know, Tim de Klerk races a horse and trap. Mm-hmm. But I think with Pogacar,
Visma Lisa Bike should start signing horses.
I don't know where I'm going with it. I'm not suggesting that Visma Lisa Bike recruit, you know, a horse and trap rider, but there is a commonality there in that I think it would be really entertaining to watch Pogacar try again and again, potentially to win San Remo, where the course and the circumstances are set against him, the difficulty of winning that race as a rider. Likewise, I'd love it, and I think it's probably more likely than not that he would have a go at Roubaix, again another race that traditionally doesn't suit someone like Pogacar, and you can talk about the quality of the opposition, but I still think there are tests that are really quite feasible for Pogacar to take on that are inherently interesting and entertaining, regardless of his dominance in the sport or whether there are riders of his physical racing capabilities. There's still a lot that he can do that I would be really interested
and
excited as a fan to see.
Yeah. And Fran said earlier that Pogacar's dominance will end suddenly and we won't see it coming. And it happens with all great sporting dynasties. I mean, again, looking for parallels, looking in other sports, I suppose that the parallel that came to my mind when thinking about this season, this kind of annus mirabilis of Pogacar's, obviously the Merckx 74, and well, there are two or three of Merckx's that bear comparison, but thinking about other sports, in golf, Tiger Woods' 2000 season is that's really put on a pedestal. He won three majors, I think he won nine events, won the US Open by 15 shots, and that is talked about as the actual, you know, the sort of pinnacle of professional golf. And that came, and there's another parallel with Pogacar in the sense that Woods was already sort of dominating. Well, he was dominating professional golf, but in the year or two before that, he'd been challenged in different ways and he decided to kind of rebuild, completely reconstruct his swing. And people sort of said, what is he doing? And all of those changes sort of fell into place in 2000 and we got the result that we did. But then afterwards, he sort of started tinkering again and things started to kind of, well, they didn't fall apart for another 9 years until, well, we know what happened with Tiger Woods. But, you know, similar to Pogacar in the sense that obviously last year there was something that led him to question a lot of what he was doing, changed coach, changed a lot of his methods, and we've had the result that we've seen this year. But it will end suddenly. As I say, we won't expect it. And age-wise, sort of he's 26 at the moment, which suggests that we probably are going to see a certain degree of dominance for the next 2 or 3 years. But I think we will see some interesting things that other teams, riders try. And the general standard, the general bar will be raised because of what he is doing. And that's another phenomenon we've seen as kind of more and more information is available. You know, things like Strava itself and Training Peaks and so on and so forth. The level has risen partly because of tools like that, because of the quality of feedback that riders now get. Every rider in the World Tour knows the level that they have to reach to beat Tadej Pogacar. It's quantified, it's empirical, and they'll strive to get there. They might not get there, but they might well do. And just talking about the year, this incredible season, Chats, I was going to ask you, and we're going to wind up the episode in a minute, but I was going to ask you, of all of the incredible performances that we've seen from him this year, which one or ones really stand out for you and for what reasons? I'll go first and give you a minute or two to think about those. You know, I talked there, Fran, about how Pogacar, he had to sort of go away last winter and rethink a few things, and obviously did make the necessary changes and with the results that we've seen. The queen stage, il tapone of the Giro, we made a kilometer zero with precisely that title about this stage, the Motolino.
Che colora le montagne di rosa e lo ha fatto anche qua a Livigno, in cima allo strappo di Motolino. Tadej Pogacar, sempre e solo lui.
Seems strange to say now, but even on the ground at that Giro, he was in the pink jersey and he sort of dominated. Okay, he didn't take the pink jersey on the first stage, but he did win the time trial in Perugia. But before that day, there was still this question mark about these big, what we refer to now as these big kilojoule stages with a lot of altitude, very long climbs. And okay, the opposition wasn't as good as the opposition that he'd faced later in the year at the Tour. But when he dominated that in the fashion that he did, I thought that was a really significant moment. Actually, yesterday, Pogacar appeared at something La Gazzetta dello Sport organizes called the Festival dello Sport in Trento. He was on stage and did a big event with, among others, our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio. And he talked about that day as probably one of the days where he's felt best in 2024. But that was kind of a significant one for me. And I suppose the sort of analogous day, I suppose you would say maybe stage four in the Tour de France, or what was the Plateau de Bay stage? The next time when he came up against Vingegaard on a stage of that nature, where again, it felt like he sort of slayed a bit of a dragon in terms of those huge sort of Col de la Loz kind of stages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking of the Volta a Catalunya, because I know that it is probably, or all the races that he has won this year, it's probably the less that is less of a marquee name to actually glorify as a place or an event to win.
The top of Port Aine in Volta Catalunya. It's 2 from 2 for Tadej. Pogacar wins stage 3.
Yet those back-to-back victories in hard stages that he had were actually the confirmation that all the narrative that there was around him with the change of methods, the streamlining of his nutrition, the new coach, the new performance advantages that he was going to use were indeed effective. Because it was not one day on which he could win, but several days in a row on which he would dominate with such a gap on the second best guy that it told you that he was a new Tadej Pogacar, that it was a new dimension of the grandeur that he could reach.
Lovely bit from Fran. Lovely bit. I can see.
Yeah, I like the sigh as well, the wistful sigh of reflection.
Anyway, Richard.
I agree with what you were saying about Tour of Catalunya as well, Fran. And actually the stage that he didn't win, stage one, but he almost won. You know, when Nick Schultz broke away, he was sort of just under the Flamme Rouge in on that stage along the coast of the Costa Brava, and Pogacar almost chased him down. But, you know, he'd come from racing San Remo, hadn't he, that weekend, so a matter of days beforehand. And all kind of racing logic would determine that that is not really on the cards for him to do. And I think, although he didn't win the stage, that race and particularly that stage just sort of set the tone for what that year was going to be like, I think. Coming off the back of, as it did, off San Remo before it and Strade Bianche as well, that really cemented that there was that sort of, let's not use cannibalism, because I think that's a sort of quite a loaded phrase in cycling, but that appetite and that like burning something that was gonna, that I think we saw through the rest of the year.
Pogacar has sat in the wheels of his teammates all day. Jorgensen checks over his shoulder and the inevitable happens as Pogacar strikes and goes away. There is no response.
I think when I think about the tour, you know, I was there to report and I was on the podcast for those victories, and I can't, to be honest, it felt like those performances on Plateau de Bay or Isola 2000, you know, that were like, they were remarkable athletic performances in terms of the numbers or the speed or that sort of thing. But there was this, by that point, there was almost an expectation or a banality to it slightly, and that become the sort of the mood around Pogacar by that point already. I think what we'd seen in the Giro perhaps. So they don't stick in my mind as clearly as the early season stuff, I think.
You were bored with the excellence at that point. Jesus.
I was hungry. I was very hungry on Isola 2000, because I think that was the stage when everything had been, like, there was literally no more food going in Isola 2000. So I do remember being very hungry on that stage. Maybe that was it, and the altitude.
Just as a final word on that, bored, not bored, how everyone is reacting to this new phase of the Pogacar reign. Richard, you read something out from L'Equipe earlier. I was just going to read something out from another colleague of ours, Italian colleague, Cristiano Gatti, writing for Tutto Bici Web, just about his feelings towards Pogacar. He wrote the weekend, "The topic is now as much of a fixture as his victories. Is Teddy," Cristiano Gatti has taken to call him Tadej Pogacar, "Teddy, is Teddy killing cycling or is he saving and reinventing it? I vote for the latter. I'm not saying this as a fan of Teddy, but as a fan of cycling, for many years, I haven't sensed such curiosity, albeit vague, uninformed and superficial, outside of the cycling community. Friends who hadn't even been paying attention from afar are slowly coming back with their blissfully ignorant questions. Will Pogacar win again? Who won the race? Was it Pogacar again? Granddads and aunties, football fans and postmen, they all know and ask about Pogacar, even if it's the only name they know. He's the household name, the household champion. Perhaps within our circle, this whole phenomenon is met with frowns, whispers of jealousy and innuendo, all seasoned with envious undertones. Unloved in his own domain, he is nonetheless a global figure now, loved by the general public, who have no vested interests or grudges. Along with Sinner, Yannick Sinner, the tennis player he is, he represents a new star-studded world of sports, one shorn of celebrity culture, nocturnal excess and tattoos by the square meter. The important thing is, out there around us, people are starting to talk about cycling again, to take a look at cycling, to consider cycling, and this is happening right in the midst of Italy's deepest crisis, by the way. I'm clinging on to this revived curiosity, this renewed interest. Moreover, I know that even the most ardent Pog haters within the cycling community will ultimately benefit from this wider resurgence, gaily hopping aboard the gravy train."
And I think of all the Super Six that we were talking about at the start of the year, Daniel, I think Pogacar is the one that I would most want to be in the position that he's in. I think as who he is as a character and the way that he races, he's the best candidate to do what he's doing now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's the most engaging of all the
And it didn't necessarily start that way. As he's become more confident, particularly with his English, and he's just become sort of more comfortable in his own skin. Obviously, he was very young when he started winning in 2019, but there is quite a lot there to like. I would suggest now. Unfortunately, the history of the sport is such that we will always, and this doesn't just apply to the haters. One name longer term listeners might be familiar with, Riccardo Rico, who of course used to ride for a team managed by Mauro Gianetti and Machin Fernandez, the same gentleman who now manage UAE Team Emirates. He's not impressed with Pogacar's domination. And if you follow him on Instagram, he's giving almost hourly updates, briefings, dispatches on how Pogacar must, well, in his opinion, not just be doping, but using some kind of motor. He's absolutely convinced of this.
He has the credibility, of course.
Yeah, he has a lot of credibility. This did make me laugh, actually. He spent Saturday night ranting about this on Instagram. And then his first story, I think on Sunday morning, was about how someone had the temerity to flag one of his activities on Strava because he'd taken 2 KOMs and someone had flagged this. Much entertainment to be had there on Riccardo Rico's Instagram. I can't remember where I was going with that. But, Pogacar, obviously the hinterland of the people who are still associated with professional cycling, in some instances, still with his team. We must never forget that. However, I would also say, look at the absence of whistleblowers not only as regards Pogacar, but the last sort of 10 years in professional cycling generally. Look at the absence of any other concrete evidence apart from that superiority itself, apart from the performances. I would say also look at the absence, and I do believe it, I do think it's genuine, of sort of suspicion on the part of people like Larry that we had on last week. The general sort of mood, the ambiance in the pro peloton, that might change, who knows, as we're into this sort of next phase of the Pogacar domination. We might start to hear rumblings of discontent, but we don't hear them at the moment, I would suggest. On that note, chaps, I'm going to thank you for your company today. Fran, we're off for lunch somewhere in Granada.
Botanico. The best terrace and best vegan menu. You're going to like it.
Best vegan menu in Granada, so Fran says.
biggest dance floor, do you remember that?
No. I'll report back next week with a review of Fran's review. Richard, thank you very much.
Thanks,
This week.
Enjoy your lunch.
Yes, I should say that the cycling isn't quite over, because this week we've got what I refer to as the Settimana Pozzatiana, the Filippo Pozzato's races in Italy, Giro del Veneto on Wednesday and the Veneto Classic on Sunday. Excellent races, particularly Sunday's race. Fantastic course. Finishing in Bassano del Grappa. We'll talk about that next week. But that is all from us this week. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
And thank you, Fran. Fran's laughing.
Thank you, man.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.